Ready? Okay, thanks. Good afternoon. This is the Design Commission. I'd like to begin by introducing first the Bureau of Development Services staff who are here today. They include Tim Herron and Kara Faravanti. Thank you. The members of the commission here today are myself, Gwen Milius, the chair, David Work, the vice chair, David Keltner, Andrew Jansky, Jane Hansen, and Ben Kaiser. Commission members are private citizens appointed by the mayor to provide review of new construction or remodeling of projects within designated design zones. We are not paid but serve entirely as volunteers. More detailed information regarding the purpose and function of the commission can be found in the Portland Zoning Code. Commission members must declare a conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contact prior to the staff presentation of a particular case. If a commission member has a conflict of interest or bias, they are not allowed to participate in commission discussion or voting on that project. If a commission member has had an ex parte contact, they must declare the substance of it on the record, and it is subject to rebuttal. We have no type 3 reviews today, so that that concludes my introduction to the commission. Our first item today is Electric Avenue, the vehicle charging stations briefing. It's a PSU project. The applicant is Stan Sitzer at PGE and Ronnie Boyle from PSU. Tim Herron is the planner presenting.
Great. I'm going to slide over because they're going to use our equipment today. But I'll invite PGE and PSU up. And this is the material you have already received on this project is in play. And this is a briefing for any future advice. And I don't suspect this should take more than 20 to 30 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Charlie Alcock. I'm the Director for Business Development at PGE, and on behalf of our many partners that pulled this project together, I'm here to give you an update and briefing on the Electric Avenue project on the PSU campus. Our partners in this project at the local level, Portland State University, George Beard and Ronnie Boyle are here in the front, and the City of Portland, of course, with Alex from PBOT and others, many other folks within the city were involved, and of course, our company from the electric utility grid, and then we have a number of private sector partners that were also part of this project. Just to quickly start, and I think you've seen many of these slides before, but we've got a number of different kinds of transportation electrification modes here in our city already and are also coming everywhere, everything from cars to streetcars to light-duty delivery trucks to heavy-duty delivery trucks, all are currently in place. And a lot of the work that we have been doing in Portland is to position Oregon as an early deployment market for these vehicles and this technology, keeping in mind the state and the city's low carbon emission standards and carbon reduction goals and things of that sort that are all at play. We're also looking to create some jobs out of all of this, and Portland State University's interest is really to understand urban mobility in this form and to become a key research center. And of course, the city in its leadership role around sustainable transportation. So last year was really the first year of deployment of these vehicles. And we are now seeing many of them in play. There are lots of reasons why people are looking at using transportation, using electricity as a transportation fuel. I don't think there's any one reason, but there are many, and different factors and different reasons appeal to residents in very different ways, and businesses are also reacting to them in very different ways. I think a lot of it has been around the volatility of fossil fuel prices. Electricity has been relatively stable, and in a way, there's a sense that you're not subjected to the ups and downs of gasoline prices, if we have seen them recently spike to over $4. The infrastructure that is coming into play, we've often wondered whether this was the chicken or the egg. I think I'm here to say that the charging infrastructure is probably the one that comes first, probably a few months before the cars show up. But clearly, the two have to come hand in hand. About 700 electric cars and trucks were sold in Oregon last year. There are 1,100 and 49 registered electric vehicles, according to DMV records, as of the end of last year. And we've had about 500 charging stations installed, both in people's homes as well as in public locations. We've got a number of different businesses that are involved in this space, many of them locally here in the Portland area. The Electric Avenue Project is a unique partnership. I think it's safe to say that it's first in North America, where we wanted to create a working demonstration showroom, not a test facility, but an actual place where charging stations are in use, different manufacturers all on one city block. And perhaps those of us who have been working in this space were getting a bit lazy because we didn't want to run all over town to demonstrate different manufacturers' charging stations. But to have them all in one place gives residents and gives the community here one place where they can come in and see all of these in use and actually use them. So we'll get into it more in the subsequent slides, but this was a partnership project between PGE and PSU. And the city of Portland. It's a two-year project really to understand charging behavior patterns, who's using them, when are they using it, as well as the system impacts on the system grid, as well as the road grid, and how does this integrate with other forms of transportation that are available at that site. So we had to go through and make a number of changes, and this is where the collaboration and the partnership really came into play. A two-way street had to be changed to a one-way street. There were a number of other things that had to get rejiggered and redesigned and thought through. This has really been a learning experience, but once the ideas came into play, we began moving fairly quickly. You can see the timelines there, but roughly 2 months to get the project up and running, with a grand opening in mid-August, and we added a second DC quick charger to that facility just recently. So it's a working showroom, a working facility, and we've been able to move chargers in and out as different manufacturers have new technologies that they want to come bring to the marketplace and to see that being in use and to get the feedback from that. So this is where we are on Electric Avenue, bordered on one side by Southwest Broadway, on the east side by Sixth Avenue, down Montgomery Street, which used to be a two-way street and converted into a one-way. There are a number of slots there. I think there are 8 parking slots, if memory serves me right, and we've got chargers, different kinds of chargers, level 1 and level 2 chargers, which is the 110 volt outlets that you see in normal homes, as well as the 240 volt chargers. And then we've got 2 quick charge stations there. And I think this is, again, one of the only locations in the United States right now where we have 2 DC quick chargers in one location. Right in the middle of campus, one block over, is the Urban Center. And you've got the MAX line, you've got the streetcar, and you've got the buses all coming to a central focal point right on that city block. So it's a very, very high visibility spot on the campus, with a lot of foot traffic going past that location. We've also seen a number of car manufacturers do their product launches or product introductions here. So we're now beginning to see photos of this site in a lot of different publications. It's all over the internet, and it's picking up that kind of visibility as well for Portland. So this is the process that we went through, identifying the need, creating that concept early on, and then really working through the partnership. And then we had to go get our technology partners, and these are the charger manufacturers. And we contacted many of them. We've got good working relationships with them. But their part of the deal was they had to bring their equipment to Portland at their cost. And some of them, you know, took a deep breath on those, but They all showed up at the end. And then going through the review process, the approval process, again, internally within the city, again, and at the university, all took took some time because a lot of these were situations we had not run into before. But to be able to go through that. And now we're into really managing day-to-day operations, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are working right and those that are challenges, as well as doing the research and the data collection and the analysis, and Portland State University is taking the lead on that. I think I covered this already in terms of the partners and the roles of the three organizations. Our technology partners, Eaton, they have, they're a global firm, but they have a manufacturing facility in Wilsonville, Oregon. They've got two different kinds of chargers. Shore Power Technologies is a local Portland firm. GE, as you know, a global company with their charge posts there. Kanematsu is a Japanese trading company. They have offices here in Portland. They are heavy into grain trade and those kinds of exports out of Oregon, but they're also into this technology, and they've been doing a number of these technology demonstration projects in Japan. SPX is a tier one supplier based in the Detroit area. OpConnect is a local firm based in Beaverton. And you can see the variety in the styles, the variety in the designs, and this really proves the showcasing effect of these different kinds of various technologies. So what we're learning in this, and I think what we wanted to do is to spend really the rest of the time this afternoon to talk about what we're learning and to engage in this conversation about where do we go next. Let's start with the what's working part, the collaboration. It's hard work, but clear roles and communication between us is really been a key to this. Doing a splash dance at the end of the inauguration or the dedication ceremony was a little bit of fun. This was the middle of August. It was probably a 100-degree day. And we enlisted a number of students and young people in our community to participate. And that was also a lot of fun. And that got a lot of the social media attention. And what also helped was having a statewide building code. It's simple, it expedited and moved things along, and to be able to see a lot of these different options there. So in terms of some of the early lessons learned, and I won't go through every one of them, but just to give you an idea, we had charging stations that went to sleep if they weren't used for a while, and we couldn't go and wake them up. This is no different than most electronic devices, but when they fell asleep, it took a while to wake them up. Little technology kinds of things, the issue of grounding, which is really, can you take these things out of a box and go install them? And we found out that, yeah, you can install them, but they don't necessarily work with every car at every time. So we had to go back and forth between the charge post manufacturers and the vehicle manufacturers to get the tolerances and those kinds of things lined up. Graffiti and tagging. Welcome to an urban environment. We get a lot of those. I think they've died down after a while, but that's certainly an issue, and I think our technology partners have gained from that to see what is involved there. This street, Montgomery Street, has a sky bridge or skywalk on that. It's a couple of flights up. And there are a number of pigeons that like to roost up above, and pigeons go do what they do, and we've had messy cars. And I don't know if we could have ever anticipated that in any of the design work, but that was the reality, and I certainly recall on opening day on August 9th, there were a number of us out there with Windex bottles at 9 a.m. cleaning it up. How would we have ever thought about that? I don't know, but again, those kinds of issues. Perhaps one of the ones that I wanted to talk about a little bit more in detail is parking signage clutter and wayfinding, and maybe we can talk about those two together. You can see the signage there. It's a new kind of behavior that we're trying to allow to happen and encourage to happen in that location. But it takes a while to get that message out there, and it is a confusing message. And, you know, even if you read English really well, you sort of have to spend a minute to figure out if that really, depicts what's allowed there and what isn't. I often wonder for our visitors to our city who may be using a plug-in vehicle, if they don't know English very well, would they get the notion there of what's allowed and when, and whether that really applies to 24/7 or whether that really applies to when one has to pay for the meter. So as we think about, right now this is just a few sites, this is one street, but as we begin to see more of this public charging in either public right-of-way or in, public parking lots and things like that around in our communities, if we want to go and encourage our businesses and our residents to use electricity as a transportation fuel to capture some of the benefits that we had talked about earlier, how do we communicate what's possible and when it's possible and all those kinds of things is I think one of the big learning experiences for us, and I think something that your commission and commissioners would be interested in getting involved. Lighting is another before I jump into lighting, let me also talk about wayfinding. Even though the PSU campus is, a fairly confined area, trying to find Electric Avenue from I-405 or Sunset Highway or any of the major arterials, you're traveling down Burnside, and if you're not familiar with the community, how do you find your way to that site is a key issue. Now, some of the vehicles come with navigation systems and things of that sort. I personally have close to 8,000 miles on a Nissan Leaf, which comes with a navigation system, and Electric Avenue does show up on my navigation system. It gets you close, but the last 100 yards to find that location is a real issue. So we're going to, as a community, have to figure out how we do wayfinding so that, you can't leave chunks of cheese down to help people find where the chargers are. So how do we do that as a community that is a simple way so that people know exactly? And also to kind of understand the other human aspect, when you are looking for your charging station, many times you're rather anxious because the needle in the battery gauge is going down and you're kind of a little nervous about those kinds of things. So there's a key human interaction factor that comes into play. Let's talk about lighting. In Oregon, we have dark nights, we have rainy nights, a lot of situations where it is really hard to see what the signage on the charging station says, and it's often dark. And if you're like me and worrying about reading glasses and those kinds of things, those things are hard to see. And then to be able to see where you plug it in into your vehicle, those start to become issues. So area lighting, and both from a security standpoint as well as being able to see what you are doing in rather inclement weather, again, is one of these things where we realize that we have quite a bit of work that we probably should do. And then charger preferences. We've got level 2 chargers there, and we also have DC quick chargers. That's something that, the DC quick charge is a lot faster. You can get probably a 50-mile range in, 10 or 15 minutes for a battery electric vehicle. So is that quick charge really what's necessary, and is that the preferred way to go, or should we have lots of these slower level 2 chargers that may take, 6 hours to charge up your vehicle? Which is the right way to go? Do you want to go the quick way or the slower way? There's probably a right combination of the two, but again, these are the things that we'll need to be thinking about as this becomes more widespread throughout our community. So that's kind of where I wanted to conclude my remarks today. There's clearly kind of the whole aesthetics notion of what should these look like when they're in the public right-of-way? Should we be thinking about a common theme around them? should we all be thinking about signage on the pavement to help, you know, mark the spots where electric vehicle charging is possible? And as we learn, we're going to run into lots of different kinds of situations. I mean, right now, you know, this is in the middle of a central business district or a university campus. What happens when we start doing these in other parts of the community? What are those situations going to be like? So we're going to go through a number of installations now where it's going to be a learning experience and an evolving process. And as you think about rules and regulations and those kinds of things, adding that sense of flexibility into it as we learn, I think is one of the lessons learned. And I think it's a real key to getting Portland going and moving forward as a lead deployment community for transportation electrification. And with that, let me conclude my remarks and open it up for questions. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much. And just for the record, Catherine Schultz is also here. Do any of the commissioners have questions of our guest? Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure.
Hey, Charlie, thanks a lot. This is really cool. What is the kind of long-term idea about deployment for these? This is a very urban condition, and it seems like there's already, you know, how does it dovetail into kind of existing fuel delivery infrastructure, right? Like all the gas stations in town. And how is that kind of, you know, which already has all the vehicular issues kind of solved. This clearly, what a great place to create a buzz, you know, and with a partner like PSU. But long term, I'm wondering how many of these issues do you see being particular to this condition, you know, where you're doing this kind of exceptional thing to kind of get things rolling versus kind of the long term, you know, future deployment of these?
You know, if I had an answer to that question, and you know, I would tell you, but I think we're all in this together. Clearly, the next piece that's going on is we have some other U.S. DOE funding and U.S. Department of Transportation funding to put quick charges along the interstate route that allows more inter-regional travel. So if you live in Gresham and you want to get to the Oregon coast, for example, you've got a series of charging stations along the way, along Interstate 5, for example. And tomorrow, you'll see the news about 8 quick charge spots along Interstate 5 between Eugene and Medford, roughly. So the southern part of the I-5 Green Highway, electric highway, will be completed. So I think the next piece is going to be around the major arterials to provide that infrastructure. So far, we have not seen the traditional fueling companies step into this space. In other countries, they have. And if you go to Japan, there are a number of instances where the gasoline or the diesel fuel supplier has gotten into this space. So I think there's a number of business models that are out there, and clearly PSU is looking and interested in researching these kinds of questions that you're talking about. Where do these go next? What's the right order and sequencing of these? I think we have to learn not by planning, but learn by doing and then kind of incorporating that into our knowledge base, and then we do the next tranche, learn from that, incorporate back into our practices. And it's this very fast iterative process that we are probably in for the next 5 years.
And kind of a follow-up, is there anything that you could tell us about as far as sort of the nature or the needs of electric refueling that might force it to have, you know, stations and that kind of thing? Or do they need to be more frequently distributed, do you think, than like current conventional fuel? Is there something that will drive it to need to be in sort of right-of-ways and denser urban conditions? Or could electric vehicles be served in a kind of similar kind of distribution to what current fossil fuel?
Well, the answer is yes, yes, and yes, right? And we're trying to figure this out. There are different kinds of cars that are going to be coming out. The Nissan Leaf that came out is a full battery electric vehicle. So all of the energy used to move that car comes from the battery in the vehicle. The other manufacturers will be introducing other kinds of plug-in vehicles. For example, Toyota will be coming out with a product this year, which is a plug-in hybrid. So there's a battery on board. The first 10 or 15 miles will be with the battery and the electricity that's stored in the battery. And then after that, it is the standard hybrid gasoline engine. The Volt came out with a different design, which is a gasoline engine that after the first 35 miles or so runs a small generator. It fills the battery back up with electricity, and that electricity runs the wheels. So I think there's going to be different kinds of technologies that are coming out. We don't know what residents here will buy. And there, you know, there's 100 variations of that story and predictions that are out there. I'm personally thinking that many residents many Oregonians will opt for the plug-in hybrid first, just because it gives them that range that they need to be able to, you know, travel far and wide and those kinds of things. So if they go that way, then the 110 circuit works just fine because you can, you know, plug that up, you can fill up the battery. It's a smaller battery in a plug-in electric vehicle a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, and you can get that charged up in, say, 3 hours. So at that point, you know, one of my strategies to suggest would be to use the existing 110 circuits and that infrastructure as much as possible, because it's already here in our homes and in our businesses, and many of them are readily available. Don't go create anything you don't need. You know, always go after sort of the lowest possible use of lowest possible cost, highest use of existing infrastructure, right? So those are the kinds of things that we're going to need to think through. And then again, when you start talking about multifamily homes and residents that live in multifamily, what's the right way to think through that? What will residents in those kinds of homes buy? People who park on streets and don't have a place to, you know, park their car, you know, at night in a garage, how will those folks take advantage of electricity as a transportation fuel? Some of the things that will come into play.
Thanks.
Great. Anyone else?
Yeah.
Okay, Andy.
So I heard they're not really making their numbers. They're not selling as many of these as they thought they were going to, and, you know, Volt put production on hold because they weren't selling enough, and I don't think Nissan sold all of them. Is there a possibility that this could be, you know, not utilized as much?
Good question. I think GM is struggling with their sales numbers right now. Nissan last year made 20,000 of the Leafs worldwide, and they sold every one of them. So, you know, and that was in spite of an earthquake that hit Japan pretty hard. So it's a good question about how quickly and how rapidly folks are going to embrace this technology. We're seeing now some movement on the fleet side of things. We're seeing some electric trucks now being used. Frito-Lay, for example, has 15 or 16 fairly large trucks in use in the Portland area, making deliveries. So I think there's a sequencing that is going to occur here. But at the end of all of this, you've got two regulatory decisions that have been made that will drive this market in this direction, and those are the new CAFE standards to 54.5 miles per gallon, and the ZEV rules the zero emission vehicle rules in California. Both of those, for compliance to occur, for the car manufacturers to comply with those two regulatory frameworks, they need to shift a good chunk, and when I mean a good chunk, it's probably set in the order of 75% of their smaller size, low footprint vehicles to some other fuel besides gasoline. I mean, that's the only way you can get there, because EPA right now, you know, puts the Volt and the Leaf, for example, at 90 or 99 or 100 miles per gallon. So if you want to get to 54, and they're still going to be selling cars that are in the 20 and 25 range, the only way the math works is to sell a bunch of cars that are at 90 and 95 and 100 miles per gallon. So you may not see anything now for a while, but the compliance rules begin to really kick into effect in 2017. By 2025, you've got major compliance requirements. So, you know, you can play the credits and allowances game for a while, and I think many of the car manufacturers will do that. But then after 2017 or 2018, and we have 5 or 6 years to go to get ready for that time, that's when things are really going to, you know, come into play. So we have that time to plan and strategize.
My concern is that, you know, you have these parking places that are like exclusive, basically, for electric cars, and they're empty all the time, and people drive by and they get irritated with this stupid electric car deal.
Unless they buy one.
So you think I don't like it? I own a Leaf, and I have 7,000 miles on it, and I got it in July, and I love it. You know, it's one of the best things ever, but I've tried to, you know, get a charging station in another place, and the owner said, I don't want to put a charging station right up front because it's going to irritate the rest of the people in this place, because there's this place that there's never going to be a car there, and there's never going to be anyone plugged in for a long time, and it's going to kind of, you know, kick back the attitude.
Right.
And, you know, so it's a challenge that I think, you know, we need them. We need them in more places, but we also need to be a little careful that we don't, you know, make this whole street have no cars on it.
Commissioner, I agree with that notion, and, you know, maybe that was one of the mistakes that we made in the 1990s when the first charging stations went in. We put them up front and very public, and they weren't used. But both as a person, in a personal capacity as a Leaf driver and everything else, I don't want the parking spot in the front of the building.
Right.
And I think from a societal standpoint and from a utility standpoint, let's put the infrastructure, these charge posts, where there's already existing electrical capacity. And it may be on the side of the building or it may be someplace, but let's do this the cheapest way possible for everybody concerned. And this is where I think you come into play when you start thinking about design criteria and where should you go and the looks and all these kinds of things. There's this other element of cost. And how do we sort of walk into this space, you know, sort of tiptoeing in and not create a set of hurdles, but to put these things in places where it is the easiest way to get them in, it's quickest, easiest, and cheapest. And we're going to learn, because this technology that we're using for charge posts right now, 5 years from now, guarantee you it'll be very different. The cars that will be sold 5 years from now will be very different. So how do we have an environment that's conducive to all of this at a time when the product's going to change, the regulations are going to change, and the technology is going to change? And that's really what we're in.
And, you know, one of the things that we were running into was this place had, I don't know if it was an internal, I think it was some kind of a city limit on the number of parking places that they could have, and they didn't want to take a parking space away. And so, you know, maybe the commission could figure out a creative letter or something to basically, if you want to be able to add an electric car charging and you have some kind of an internal or city limit, that it wouldn't, you know, deduct from that. And that would help organizations really want to do it, because, you know, just to go through that process, they're like, nah, we don't want to, it's not worth it to us. So, you know, maybe we could help the city process along or something. So, and I've used the level two there and the level three, and the level three is very satisfying. The level two, it's kind of like a waste of time. Really, it's just, it takes too long.
Well,
after I've owned the car long enough, I determine how far I need to go, and I go use it. And sometimes I go home with 1 mile on the thing flashing to get home, but you know, once you use it, you learn to not need a charger. And, you know, for a couple times I've gone down there for the novelty of it, but it, you know, it's, but the level two is, or the level three is definitely worth it, and it's fast, and, right. You know, it's, it people traveling, it would be a good thing, but you're right, it's hard to find, it's hard to get in there, and I think the signage is terrible. The, you know, all of the city required standard signage, you look at it, it's just littered with signs, and I watched someone come in, park, and they couldn't figure out the signs. They had a normal car, and they were talking to each other, and like, well, does this apply to us? And which one of these signs? And it's just, you know, I think you need to work on a better way to, you know, make it clear that, you know, what the rules are. And then there was a guy that was parked in the level three Charger for, I think he was there for a long time, but his car was done. And I wanted to use it. And so, you know, he had the 8-hour ticket, and he basically was there. He was charging, but he was done. So, you know, the level two chargers, you could take 6 hours, but the, you know, like you said, the level three, you're done in an hour. So you might want to figure out a way to segregate the time limits. But, you know, that's just going to add a whole other sign. And you're going to have 8 signs. But, you know, I think it's a great idea, and it's a lot of people, I've seen them walking up and down looking at, just checking out the equipment, because it's pretty cool. It's, you know, shiny, you know, stainless steel stuff, and, you know, I think some interpretive signs or, you know, something to explain it a little better about what it is and the systems and, you know. You know, I think we should have, you know, a story where the power comes from. And you know, I mean, it is clean technology, but it does come from dams, which kill salmon. It comes from windmills that kill owls. It comes from gas turbines that, you know, I mean, it's not like a guaranteed save the world, but it has a story that people should know. But, yeah, thank you for, you know, doing it. I think it's a great thing. So.
Thanks, Andy. Other commissioners who have questions? Yeah.
Andy knows a lot about this, but just the mechanics. How long for the quick charge and the long charge? And I'm. Do you have to pay for these charging stations to charge your car? I don't know.
Let me take those questions one by one. During the times when the city has the parking system going, those are the hours where you've got to buy a parking ticket or tag, and then the electricity at that point is supplied by Portland State University. It's a sponsored site. So it's, think of it as the electricity is included in the parking fee.
And the parking fee is a standard?
It's a standard $1.60, I think, on, you know, an hour at that site. So that's how it's done. And you're going to start to see other business models show up where there's a different charge structure. The EV project that that Ecotality is putting into our community, probably by this summer, will have a different kind of payment system where you need a card to kind of get the system going, and the fees end up coming up on your credit card. So we're going to be trying different kinds of systems, and different businesses will probably have different models that will be out there. The level two charge, well, and when we come to the question about how long does it take to charge, most of the car manufacturers assume that the battery is completely empty to answer that question. So, you know, very, very rarely do you ever get to that point. But if you are an owner of a 2011 Nissan Leaf, the battery is 24 kilowatt hours. You charge it up at 3 kilowatt hours an hour, so it takes you 8 hours at 240. The same car 2012 model is in half. It charges faster, so it takes 4 hours to do that. On a quick charge, you know, it rarely is at zero. But if it were at zero, to get to 80% of the capacity of the battery is no more than 30 minutes. And they'd say that because the battery acts like a thirsty human being when it's really low, you drink water very, very quickly, and by the time you're on your fifth or sixth glass of water, you've really slowed down. The battery does the same thing. I think when you're really using quick charging, in 10 minutes, you may get 50 miles worth of range. At that point, the next 10 minutes, you might get 10 miles worth of range. Is it worth to you or not? If you really like the latte that you're enjoying in the coffee shop around the corner, you may stay. But I think for most of us, we say 50 is enough. Fine, 10 minutes, we're gone.
Interesting. Has PGE come across that technology I've been reading about in Israel, that the replaceable battery, and kind of not a charging station, but just battery stations?
I think there are going to be all kinds of different technologies going to come out. We've looked at that. That's the system that you're referring to is called Better Place. Our sense, as we took the look at it, was that it works in more restricted markets and islands and things of that sort, where you can come to some agreement on the size and the shape of the battery and maybe use it with just a limited number of vehicles. In markets like Oregon, where you've got traffic coming from every which way and the I-5 and all of that, I think those kinds of standardizations are going to be probably pretty difficult to do.
Because I agree with David about since it would be unfortunate, I think, if we set up a whole system that parallels the fossil fuel system, so we just have that many more fuel stations, just doubling the amount of fuel stations around. So, which I guess it sounds like your dreams came true and that all came to fruition, we'd have equal amount of cars and maybe at some point the majority of cars on electric. So then we'd have these gas stations and electric stations all around a city. So it just
well, that's true. But from a design in a community design standpoint, I think there are different behaviors that occur, and maybe they will eventually end up being the same. But right now, when you go to a traditional fossil fuel refueling station in liquid form, you're in, you're out of there in 3 to 5 minutes. You may run in and get a soda or something, but it's a very quick transaction.
Sure.
Now, maybe at some point it'll be the same with the electric, but today we're not. So I think that's one of the differences. The other thing is, you know, will we have fossil fuel dispensers right next to electrical inspectors, or are there enough building codes and electrical codes and all kinds of other codes that require that physical separation? I don't know those kinds of answers. Those are things that we need to probably, you know, continue to explore. Do you want to have dispensers on city sidewalks? I mean, that's another good question. Or should they, you know, we encourage them to be sort of tucked in and off public streets? I mean, those are all things that we're going to, as a community, talk about and come to some kind of planning guidelines around how we want to provide for this capacity. And then we start worrying about where the electrical infrastructure is, right? And again, that gets into the cost question. The minute we touch concrete, the minute you touch asphalt, the prices go through the roof. So clearly minimizing that. Second thing is, you know, without incurring a whole lot of cost, because right now the building market is really soft, but it's cheaper to put the infrastructure in ahead of time. So while you're going through a quick remodel, while you're going through a new building or a new expansion, if you have a chance to throw in at least some conduit, you know, don't worry about any of the other stuff, but at least put some of that capacity in, that may be a very good idea to encourage in the early years until we get a much better handle for this technology. And then becomes a thing you've got to do. But at the early days, I think it's really more to support this, to give it lift.
It is interesting as the confluence of these technologies, because I'm sure soon there will just be an app to show you the location of all the charging stations so that they can be in more discrete places as opposed to the intersection of major thoroughfares with a big canopy and fluorescent lighting. These things can be pretty discreet back in alleys and behind buildings, and a Leaf owner could find them.
It already is.
Oh, is there? So
they're way ahead of you.
So they can be, they don't have to be in old station locations, right, where you just drive and
of course there might be 10 left-hand turns around because the traffic pattern is all special that you might not be able to get to it
in time,
which, you know, this is kind of like that. You got to take three left turns and a right and go straight down. You know, it's, mm-hmm. if you're coming from somewhere else, it's hard to get to. So one of the questions I had was, so this is a perfect example of some of the things that we specifically look at, which is a clutter on the right of way. And why do they need to be so big? I know why the level three needs to be so big, but I can get my level two modified, and it's as big as a laptop, basically. A laptop, mm-hmm. a big giant laptop charger, and then it's got a cord, and you can get that modified to be 220. So why do they need to be so big?
Well, they look like they're, some are much sleeker than others. And
yeah, there's mm-hmm. nothing in
that's kind of what, where I was, if I could join in with you here.
Yeah.
It's a riff. It is, just to kind of riff on you, yeah. You mentioned quickest, easiest, and cheapest. I'd like to add a few more verbiage to that. Quality and visual appearance mm-hmm. might want to be factored in, and that's where this visual clutter, this visual noise, we've got light poles, trash cans, recycling cans, compression cans, recycling items. We've got about 20 other items within that right-of-way. So if these are going to be proliferate in the right-of-way, then there's some design aspects to that that I think we all are probably willing to weigh in on. And part of that is trying to minimize them as much as possible so that they are as thin, as small, but then there's also the balance of making them kind of obvious enough so you can find them and see them, right? So there's already a tension between those two things. The other would be the signage. I actually walked by this long before this came up on the agenda, and I was struck by how interesting the whole concept was, but also at the same time kind of taken aback by all the visual litter that is just present, how confusing it was. And so there's got to be a system worked out where it's much cleaner, minimized to the point, you probably are already addressing all these things, but just to kind of get it out there. And then the other thing is probably lighting. If there are five or six, you know, three on one block and three on the next block, and you're going down Fifth or Sixth Avenue, whatever, it becomes at night a particularly probably irritating aspect of trying to wayfind in a city environment. So the fact that maybe there's a real subtle light and then it's activated for the actual task at hand to plug it in as you're working on it. So there might be something to that effect where it's basically, it switches on to allow the user to hook up. I was also interested in are you, in testing this, I assume you're giving feedback to manufacturers so they can maybe incorporate some of these ideas. And,
right.
Yes?
And Dr. Beard here and Ronnie are taking copious notes because we are going to give some of that feedback, exactly the kind of feedback you're talking about. And this is a dialogue that we're having with the charge post manufacturers.
Right. Okay. Anyway, just to...
So the other thing that we have basically on every block is the traffic or the meter.
Parking meter.
Parking meter.
Yeah, we already have a parking meter dispenser that probably doesn't need all...
Right.
It's another wayfinding tool mostly.
Right.
You know, the computer doesn't take up that much.
Something that...
Space.
I think they're solar, but something that, given the size of that thing, it'd be very easy to have a little charging station built into it.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great idea to combine those two things because you'd look for those. You know where they are on each block.
But then you run into this exclusive use deal where you put a big sign that says no parking and they're all empty. Mm-hmm. And then people hate electric cars.
Yeah. Or maybe they start buying them.
They start buying them. But they cost too much.
Yeah. Right. But even if it was just one spot on each block associated with the meter.
Right.
Yeah. Then there'd be an even distribution, and it kind of gets, you wouldn't have sort of, because it seems like the thing about this being head in is that it is really concentrated, and it seems like it would be, I don't know, better if some way you were able to do it with parallel parking and it wasn't just a block of head-in parking on a particular block if you were going to distribute it through the city.
Yeah. Right. I think that's the real question is as we begin to distribute this throughout the city in very different situations than we have here today, what does that look like? And I think that's really the start of the dialogue that we need to have.
Right.
Because if you want to do this on Southeast 52nd Avenue, what would that look like? You want to do this, Northwest 23rd, what would that look like? I mean, I think those are the kinds of questions that we'll need to start to really think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the big things, too, is if you take it out to 2025, which you mentioned as being a mm-hmm. threshold year, is what percentage of cars would be utilizing potentially this type of technology, then hopefully a lot of them would be in garages then, mm-hmm. right? Possibly. Mm. There'd be a charging aspect to that. But the other part is, you don't want them to take the place of a parking meter at every meter, right. And having, five or six per block, every face of every block. It just isn't.
Yeah. Now, there's some value to concentration. And even from just the electricity standpoint, our infrastructure would be a lot easier if we could sort of put a bunch in one place and then have some, some distance away.
Other questions? I've got a few. Do you mind if I take on, and then we'll pass to comments if we like? So I guess one of my questions that sort of popped in my head when you were talking about the business approach, people electrifying their fleet, and if you guys are taking any lessons from that process and in their retrofitting of facilities, and are there any specific downtown businesses that are retrofitting that are keeping fleets, maybe stored in garages, and are going through a retrofit, and what are they finding is useful in siting charging stations?
Good question. Let me sort of take them in pieces.
Sure.
The Frito-Lay and the Staples examples are, they're based out of distribution centers on Marine Drive at about 162nd, 181st, somewhere out in that area near the airport. They use that as the depot. They charge there, and then every morning at 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, they're loaded up, and they make deliveries in the downtown area. And they go back to that depot at night. So that's how they do things. So the charging stations are inside their facilities, behind a fence, and for the most part, they look like proprietary systems for their own use. We are working with those businesses to understand charging and what it takes and what kind of infrastructure they're putting in. And again, that's an example of the collaboration that we're doing with Portland State University to understand those kinds of uses. Enterprise rental car on Southwest 16th up at Burnside. That facility has a number of Leafs for rentals every day. So we're beginning to see that kind of use. I know that there's another delicatessen that provides lunch delivery services that is using an electric vehicle. We have a number of businesses like pizza businesses that are using electric vehicles for urban deliveries. So I think that's kind of where things are at. I wouldn't be surprised if I could anticipate a little bit into the future we're going to see businesses in the sort of the downtown core area want to say things like, we'd like to have our suppliers deliver to us using electric trucks and those kinds of things. Then the question becomes, how do you create sort of a communal charging area that all of the truck drivers could use over time? Instead of having them, scattered all over the place, is there a common place that they can go to? Maybe the same thing would apply for taxi cabs, where they, while they are waiting, could they charge up? I think those would be some of the areas that, we might want to think about a kind of a common facility that a whole number of folks could use. I think those are the kinds of things that are sort of in the immediate future of things that would enable and promote transportation electrification to keep going forward.
Okay. And I gather that you're getting here on statistics, but do you have any preliminary numbers on who's really using the charging station and who's driving an electric vehicle around town? I mean, one of the things that you mentioned was the sort of steep learning curve that people have, just finding the stations and understanding how to charge their vehicle, and I'm assuming that over time we'll expect that learning curve to flatten.
I would hope so. Most of the charging right now seems to be occurring in homes. By far, like 80 or 90% of all charging is happening in the home. But I think the first batch of us that bought these vehicles also were more primed to do that. We had to go through a self-evaluation and assessment process. We had to own our own home. We had to be there for promise to live there for a couple of years. There was a certain budget that was given to us to participate in the early projects. So it was really, I would say, a contrived, maybe contrived is too harsh of a word, but it was certainly a clear subset. Mm-hmm. As this thing sort of goes forward and now these cars are available for everybody to purchase and all of that, we're going to start to see more differences and more nuances of broader use. And I'm not quite sure how that is going to get changed in terms of that behavior. You know, if you lived in a multifamily dwelling, for example, and you don't have charging where you live, where your head hits the pillow at night, what are your options? I don't know if we have any answers to that question yet. I mean, we're going to try to study it as best we can, but these are the questions that we will, as a community, have to face in the next couple of years.
And then is the plan to sort of whittle the number of manufacturers that are represented on Portland streets down? Is it, I know now it's just sort of who all comers or whoever won the RFP shows up,
right.
But, you know, Portland has a tendency to move towards standardization of its street furniture. So, I mean, we're talking already about combining things and finding ways to tie this into other existing pieces, but...
You know, when we got into this space, really in a big way 4 years ago, there were probably half a dozen charger manufacturers. Last count, I gave up at 37. And there are more entering this space with different kinds of variations, different kind of features. It's a very, very rapidly moving market. And we haven't talked about telemetry. We haven't talked about all kinds of other things that are coming along with all of this. George?
If you would come forward and read your name and your address into the record, it would really help us. Thank you. No problem. Thanks for coming.
Hi, George Beard with Portland State University. I just want to add to your very good question. The instinct probably to want to standardize fairly early is completely rational. I want to signal to you, though, our posture right now, this is a two-year term project. So by definition, it's a research and development project. So in fact, we're going to do the opposite. We will continue to invite in vendors and technologies that we think are worth evaluating. And I would caution probably against standardizing too early. This is more of a marathon than a sprint. But I would also salute you for your instincts, because there's a great deal of randomness. And when you look at the venue that we have, it's in some ways it is unsightly. It's not very economical. It's not very durable. So I can warrant to you that we're interested in not only evaluating those factors, but even taking your Pepsi challenge to go in and be your eyes and ears and fingers to work with you on doing that.
Right. I mean, I imagine that not all 37 of the vendors you counted are making products that are appropriate for an urban setting already, and that perhaps some of the lessons that you're learning from the 6 installations that you have might inform a future RFP, you know.
I think that's right.
Have it do this, but not that, you know, and it sort of whittles the, the performance spec becomes clearer.
I'm very intrigued, too, by the notion of consolidating devices to the extent that we can challenge our vendors to perhaps come up with a design that also issues parking permits and maybe even appropriate information kiosks. They're useful to passersby, to the citizenry, without hawking products, could be pretty interesting. So when you look at all these standalone devices, how do you integrate them for the urban experience of people on the move? That's an interesting proposition.
I mean, you could see a situation, again, maybe it's not every street, but where the parking kiosk is also a charging station. And so one could park next to it and charge one could also buy parking at it and park another gas-powered vehicle or an electric vehicle that didn't need to be charged, you know, in all the other parking spaces. And the signage solution that I saw in that photo, as you know, is not a good one. I mean, it seems sort of like the hammer to fit, paint to match sort of approach. It was probably the cheapest thing. Take an existing no parking sign, and then we'll just put the electric vehicle thing on the bottom, and it'll be fine. Everyone will understand it. Of course, they don't. So I would love to see, you know, you work with PBOT to come up with one sign, or, like you said, I mean, it could be more of an interactive interface where you can clearly understand what's going on here at the press of a button, instead of having to paint it on a piece of metal and bolt it to something.
Madam Commissioner, if I might add one other thing for you to give consideration to in the future, it's highly unlikely you're going to see one-size-fits-all, one-approach-fits-all types of design offerings here. But I would tell you, one of the things that we've learned from Electric Avenue, a consolidated venue that we didn't happen upon accidentally, but we came upon serendipitously, is that it is right next to the mobility hub that we call the 6th Avenue Transit Mall. And so someone can come in there, park, and charge for a period of time and hop on the light rail train or hop on the Portland streetcar, maneuver around on electrons. And I think for certain settings, for instance, for the new Orange Line that'll be coming up, we've had some discussions with TriMet about clustering rather than scattergramming charging stations around. So it's not either or, but there, depending on the setting, there's occasions when it makes sense to consolidate safe venues that have access to hospitality services and are secure and all of that. So
okay.
We've learned a lot so far.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yes, we have.
Other comments, questions?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, Jane hasn't had a chance. Go ahead. You haven't had a crack at it. Okay. So.
Well, I guess I just have one question about the quick charge stations versus the ones that take longer. Is there any downside to the quick charge stations? Are they harder on batteries? Is there any reason? Is that the trend that the charging time is becoming less and less?
There is no real impact on battery life or battery quality. I think the battery management systems, which is a computer system that is in every vehicle, is pretty smart. And if it's taking in too much power too quickly, it slows it down, and it goes into a self-protection mode. So I don't think that's much of an issue. The problem with some of these quick chargers is the upfront sticker price. These things are expensive. Now, there are movements afoot to knock these prices down significantly. I mean, right now they're manufactured in limited quantities. Once you get into mass scale, these prices will be coming down. So that's kind of the one big difference, is the level two chargers, the one that you see in the middle and onto the right, are a lot cheaper to manufacture than the DC quick charger that you see on the left.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, and David, sorry.
Okay. So some more comment and questions.
I think we're moving to comments.
Okay. You said quick, cheap and easy. It seems like this location where you've chosen to do this is, you can do better for a kind of position in terms of relationship to PSU and visibility. And as far as like trying to get more people to know this technology is available, it's a killer spot. Mm-hmm. I'd also say that the aspect of this charging system that it takes right now, at minimum 30 minutes to kind of bring something up, means that you want to be charging this thing somewhere where you can go do something or mm-hmm. leave the car. And mm-hmm. that was the key that I was looking for that differentiates it from the kind of isolated gas station experience that we currently have. I mean, you're in and out of there, and it's not a place you want to be. Now you need to do this somewhere where you do want to be mm-hmm. with the current technology. Mm-hmm. So while that makes sense, and this makes sense for this kind of venue of publicity, I have a real question in my mind if this kind of thing belongs in the right-of-way, in particular in dense urban environments. And I'm trying to think of a parallel use that we currently dedicate to the right-of-way. I was trying to think, what if we distributed fossil fuel this way and there were pipelines underneath all of the sidewalks and we had a very clean way of distributing it? Would we want to make the convenience of people being able to fuel wherever they were? Probably not.
It'd be like five-hour parking in the Lloyd District, but everywhere downtown, if we allowed this to sort of proliferate in the right-of-way.
Well, it just seems like, yeah, and it seems like actually because there's a benefit to being in a position more time, it's like another incentive to leave your car, like to bring your car downtown and leave it there for a while. And we have the opposite philosophy. We're like, we're going to charge as much money as we can to discourage you.
Exactly.
It's why I ride my bike. It's like, it's really hard to park downtown. Well, you know, driving and even if, you know, it's with the rechargeable electric vehicle, it's taking up space in our urban places with more parking spaces, or it's taking money away from, you know, PBOT, you know, who's trying to pay for everything through their parking fees.
So like pods somewhere a little out that are maybe free, or, you know, to encourage people.
Yeah, or like transit, mass transit centers, or.
Well, I can hear the Downtown Retailers Association taking in a sharp breath when we start saying things like, make more of these in the right-of-way and parking spots and make it okay to park for 6 hours downtown. Because those parking spots that are 90-minute and 2-hour are meant for people that are there to shop and have lunch and do the things that people drive into town to do, not to commute.
It's a really good idea. It's like a flipping the whole concept of what it's about.
So I think we're in an interesting moment in this where you're experimenting with some things. Mm-hmm. The current technology requires it's not a cars to be in a place for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that seems like the trajectory of that is to get faster and quicker,
yes,
and easier. But I don't know that this is really, I think we could get into like, what are these things going to look like? How many of them can you have? Do they go at every single parking space? But I mean, I would first want to ask the question, should we allow these in the right of way? And here, I mean, for sure, it's like this is a different beast. It's a standalone thing. It's at a moment in time where it's trying to publicize something. But in long-term projection of the city, I mean, would we not just approach this the same way? We wouldn't put a gas pump in the right-of-way. Why would you put an electric pump in the right-of-way?
It seems like this is a continuation of trying to reward people in the current system to drive a different vehicle and giving them that upfront spot and that preferred spot so that they would, in fact, use a vehicle that is a different vehicle in many ways, and you get rewarded for that. But it's an extension of that same thing then. And so I guess, do we keep rewarding people in the right of way?
Well, and I'd say, I mean, the caveat is that six-hour and eight-hour charges, I mean, is one thing, but if you can do a quick charge in a half an hour, then it could be the same as someone taking a gas-powered vehicle down and half an hour.
If it continues on its current trajectory, and we're all dependent on technology progressing at a faster and faster rate, I would assume that by 2025, you've got a battery that would go 100 or 200 miles and require maybe, you know, you've got a little packet and you put it in there and you go another 200 miles or whatever, you know. But so it's probably not going to go on the line we're all thinking. Technology always has a way of creating its own path, so it may all be moot. But until that time, I kind of agree with David. Is this something that really proliferates in the right-of-way because you're rewarding a different kind of approach to encouraging people to drive.
It would be easier to put in city parking garage.
Yeah.
Some of the smart parks where they have power garages
and that are existing. Yeah.
Have you, Charlie, approached smart park or anything?
We have had those conversations. Again, you know, parking structures, if they were not designed, I mean, many of them were designed just for a lighting load, and they don't have the electrical infrastructure in place. Retrofit costs get very, very expensive. And Commissioner Wark, getting back to your point about the right-of-way, one of the things about the right-of-way that is appealing from the electric utility standpoint is that we have infrastructure
already there.
And from a cost standpoint, you know, we're in and out of the right-of-way a lot. And we're familiar with doing business in the right-of-way. Mm-hmm. And that was a one of the key considerations that city staff shared with us is they prefer somebody who is used to working in the right-of-way of being there. And that was one of the considerations that came into play.
It seems, though, with all the condominium owners that would probably have a parking space, now with a gas vehicle, but inner city, that they, you know, if you could get in an agreement with some of the condominium owners too, you know, to say, let's do some pilot tests in those buildings, inside buildings. It seems like you're doing all the testing in right away. The natural progression is to test inside buildings now, in garages. Yeah.
Those conversations are beginning to happen.
Sure.
Yeah.
Catherine, did you?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I'm already running into it in other jurisdictions. It's just required. Mm. It's just a flat-out requirement.
In your buildings?
In California, it's a requirement. You have to provide a certain number of your parking spaces. A percentage has to be charging space stations, and we probably just need to start getting there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's interesting.
How would you deal with, like, some of the cars don't, like, the Leaf has the charging port on the front, and that works pretty good with this head-in space. But some of them have them on the left side, and if they're parking on the right side of the street, then you got this cord going out and this thing sticking out about this far into the bike lane.
That's for another appearance.
You can only park on the left side.
It's like a one-way street, right? Yeah.
I'm also having visions of all the attendants having to stand there and charge it. Because, we're requiring gas stations. Aren't we going to start requiring attendants to charge it for you?
Oh, right, in Oregon, you can't pump your own electricity.
Right.
But you can smoke next.
Yeah, right. I guess you could.
So I was just going to encourage, you know, as it seems like there's a lot for you to tackle just with this technology and getting it out there. And I would venture so far as to say, you know, maybe don't invest too much of your time necessarily trying to, like, how are we going to get this into these really busy public right-of-ways? And instead ask, you know, maybe there are easier places, you know, to go as a part of the research, unless there's something about it other than being easy, you know, that for you guys that would make it need to be in that position.
But we appreciate this opportunity to come and be part of this, to start this dialogue. And we came here really not so much as to make a presentation, as to start this dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is our community, and we need to sort of together help design and shape this forward. I don't think there are any silver bullets. I don't think there are any magical answers. This is one where we need to do and learn and then, you know, adapt and to keep this cycle going. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where the collaboration with the city, the university, our company, and as well as many of the other technology partners really comes into play. So I'd like to suggest that we keep this conversation going at another venue, but to keep this thing as an iterative conversation going, because I think we've just sort of really scratched the surface around future urban mobility.
Yeah. Well, we'd love to have you back. Are there any other final comments?
Well, I guess I would just like to say that, I agree that, you know, you wouldn't want to see a proliferation of them everywhere. I still think Andy's idea about combining them with the parking meters, if you had them in a few key spots and the parking meter was a different color, it was blue or something, and then you would know that in a case of an emergency, there was a place to go where you could charge, but you're not making all the streets, you know, charging streets or something. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like it's fairly discreet. And if the technology is making it smaller and the charging is occurring faster, it seems like, if you can get it in under an hour, then it's a lot more reasonable than a 4 to 8 hour charge, which just doesn't seem like it fits with just kind of urban life. But
yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's, you know, I work with Eaton on marinas, and they have power pedestals that have plug-in modules for whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'd be very easy for the parking meter to have a plug-in module that has the charger or not. And, you know, Eaton, that's one of their specialties. Is there anything that we can do to help? I mean, are you running into, any parking issues with, CAP or any of that kind of stuff that, you know, maybe a commission could, you know, would help break city bureaucracy for, approval stuff for private buildings that might have a cap or whatever, just that kind of stuff.
Commissioner George Beard with Portland State, that's such a marvelous opportunity. We'll get back to you. But I want to say the more important thing is that all kidding aside, the city has been magnificent to work with. And on the public record, they have been not only PBOT, but the mayor's office, everyone we've had occasion to work with has done a terrific job and is a great partner. Now, the one thing that I challenge you back with is to the extent that you have either anxieties or policy interests that you can communicate back to us, to the extent we can incorporate that or issue the Pepsi challenge to a vendor to see if they could come up with an omnibus device that had curb appeal and durability and did multiple things, that would be great. And Portland should be a leader in that. So if you can give us those, the benefit of your thinking, we'll carry your water on it.
Okay.
Or together we carry the water together in these conversations.
So we need to add a waste basket to that.
Yeah. Trash compactor.
Crosswalk signal and
bike lock.
Light, street light.
And if it could make a coffee.
Cell phone charger.
And cell phone charger. Could be that easy.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for coming today.
Quick charge.